Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Television pioneer Rune Arledge died yesterday after a long battle with cancer. In a career that spanned more than four decades, the creator of Monday Night Football, Nightline, World News Tonight, and much more changed the way we see the world. In this hour, the impact of a TV titan and a look at the future of television. We begin in Baghdad, where this weekend, Iraq is required to turn over a detailed accounting of any and all weapons of mass destruction. Iraqi officials continue to say they have none. The U.S. and Britain say their intelligence shows otherwise. Scott Peterson is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. Earlier, I asked if Iraq's declaration is likely to move events toward resolution or greater tension.
That really is going to depend on how it is interpreted by the United States and also how it's interpreted by the United Nations weapons inspection teams. It's going to be a vast document. It could be as large as 13,000 pages. We just heard Hans Blix, in fact, who's the head of the weapons inspectors, the chief weapons inspector, tell us in the United Nations that it's going to take some time before they can even begin to disseminate some of that information to members of the Security Council. But I think in terms of its substance, we are looking toward a collision course because the Iraqis still say that they have no weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq or any evidence of those. They say that they were all destroyed by previous weapons inspection regimes. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got the United States saying that, in fact, they're sure that they have intelligence indicating that such programs exist and that that this may be a cause for war.
The United States and Iraq, I suppose each country has its own agenda. Is there any third party with a view here of whether or not Iraq does in fact still have weapons of mass destruction, or do we just have to depend on digging and fighting to figure it out?
Most people recognize that the vast majority of Iraq's arsenal of these types of weapons were destroyed in the 1990s by UN inspection teams back then. What the question are being raised about is what residual material is left. There are hundreds of tons of precursor material for VX nerve agent, apparently a dozen Scud missiles, which they believe are unaccounted for. There are other things like that that are really left over. It's just a fraction of the amount of material that Iraq once had, but still some analysts figure that that could be quite dangerous. And, of course, the other question is, what has Iraq done in the 4 years since weapons inspectors left Iraq? And the United States is convinced that Iraq has done a lot, but there are also plenty of other analysts who would argue that, in fact, not much has been done, that Iraq hasn't had the capability, that past U.S. efforts to contain Iraq have made it clear that Iraq has not been able to marshal any kind of a major WMD program.
Scott, Iraq has been very clear in saying it has no weapons of mass destruction. It has said that repeatedly. Is anyone expecting that it will reverse that position and in the documents that it submits over the weekend outline lots of weapons of mass destruction or any? Is it possible that it might turn around and make an announcement, yes, we have them, we're coming clean?
Well, if they did make such an announcement, then it would really put the United States and Britain in a bind because they are the ones who are pushing hardest for a strong and aggressive military reaction if Iraq doesn't come clean. They are making many of their current policy decisions based on the likelihood that Iraq is not going to come clean. And so if Iraq does actually produce some quite startling information, for example, about the material that weapons inspectors believe they found out about, things that were unaccounted for in 1998, if Iraq actually accounts for all of that material and maybe even includes a few other fresh, newer, juicy tidbits, then that really could, I think, raise some questions in Washington.
Why would Iraq not come clean now? If they still have weapons of mass destruction or precursor materials, as you call them, materials that would help them make such weapons, why not just lay them all out there? What game is going on here?
There are many who argue that weapons of mass destruction have always been a critical part of this regime in terms of maintaining the myth of power, in terms of maintaining a myth of keeping control and being a regime that needed to be reckoned with. That has been part and parcel of the policy of this government of Saddam Hussein for the past 20 years, And there are legitimate questions about whether or not the regime could survive a serious undermining of that reputation, which is probably what would happen if it actually was seen to give up all aspects of its weapons of mass destruction ambitions.
But if it hangs on to those weapons and thereby invites an international or a United States massive attack, that would seem to be self-defeating.
You are absolutely right, and I think that that is the calculation that Saddam Hussein is making right now. I think that they want to give the appearance of total compliance. Whether that is, in fact, full compliance or not will remain to be seen, but they definitely want to give the appearance of being as open, as concise, and as clear as possible, so that even if they don't convince the United States and Britain, which they're unlikely to do, then they will at least convince Russia and France, which are two other permanent voting members of the UN Security Council. And if Russia and France are on their side and won't vote for a resolution for war, then that means we have, yet again, a split Security Council. And it means that the United States and Britain need to go back to the diplomatic hard labor to try and bring more people into the coalition.
Scott, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz said this week that it will be a miracle if war does not occur in Iraq. It's a holiday weekend there with the end of Ramadan. What's the mood in Baghdad? Are people resigned to war? Are they expecting war?
Probably in many respects they are resigned to war. They don't want it to happen, this is for sure. But I spent part of today at a Luna Park, fantastic and very large carnival area in Baghdad. It was absolutely packed full of people. They were expecting 40,000 people a day during each of the 3 days of the Eid holiday. And so what was remarkable is in speaking to Iraqis there, they made it clear that the possibility of war was not affecting their daily lives. I think they were really trying to kind of be in denial and push it out of their minds. They certainly were having fun today at the Luna Park. And they also recognized that these things are almost entirely out of their hands, and therefore there's nothing to do but be resigned.
Scott Peterson, keep your head down. We'll talk again soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us earlier today from Baghdad. Tonight we're remembering television revolutionary Rune Arledge, whose influence only begins with the phalanx of shows he left behind.
What we've got tonight is two of the most intense rivals in pro football, the Washington Redskins against the always excellent Cowboys.
The thrill of victory and the agony of defeat.
Monday Night Football 2020, Wide World of Sports Nightline, and there was more. Not too shabby a lineup for a man who started off producing a puppet show with Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop. For the last three decades, the influence of Rune Arledge on American TV has been second to none. With high-tech wizardry and his up-close and personal approach of relentless storyline, heroes, and heroines, he brought the world closer to America. He brilliantly packaged the human experience and brought it into our living rooms, from the Iran hostage crisis to the irresistible pixie charm of Olympic gymnast Olga Korbut. Arledge is credited with bringing journalism to sports. But did he also bring the breathless artifice of sports into journalism, turning the news into a razzle-dazzle extravaganza of glitz and emotion? Is the medium that Rune shaped working for you, for the country, for all its appeal? Is TV all it could and should be? Is it too packaged and polished? And where is television headed next? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined from Syracuse, New York, by Bob Thompson, professor and director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. Good evening and welcome, Bob Thompson.
Good evening. Thanks.
Thanks for being with us. Bob, what was it with Rune Arledge that made him such an enormous force in television, such a giant rock in this pond?
Well, you know, it's amazing. I think if you'd have asked the average American 2 days ago, before the story of his death broke, who Rune Arledge was, I doubt most people outside of the communication industry could have even told you. And we're now seeing passing all of the people who may not be household names, may not be names that most people have even ever heard of, that really did shape the way we experience American life. Pat Weaver was one of them, who invented the morning shows and the late night shows. Mm-hmm. And Rue Narlage was certainly another one of them. I suppose the first place to start would be sports. You know, television and sports was a marriage made in heaven, and sports broadcasting started way in the mid-40s when television began. But Rue Narlage was really the midwife that kind of brought the really sophisticated child from that marriage of television and sports. Up until the point that he got into the business, sports coverage was pretty much putting some cameras up there, covering the game, having a few interviews, and that was about it.
And it was weekend, and it was daytime.
Right, exactly. And Rue Narlage decided that sports had a whole new aesthetic realm available to it that could bring whole new audiences that heretofore had not dreamed of watching sports. And the 1-2 punch of Wide World of Sports and Monday Night Football, and then those extraordinary Olympics that he covered, 68, 72, 76, new technologies, instant replays, slow motions, bouncing things off of satellites, live broadcasts, up close and personal. He turned the Olympics into this amazing dramatic miniseries, and to this day, Olympic coverage is still very much reflecting the heritage of Rue Narlage.
We read that Rue Narlage bought the first American rights for the Olympics for $200,000. I think the last one went for $500 million plus.
Yeah.
It starts with the technical, then, as you say. I mean, he introduced instant replay, slow motion studies of that human body in motion, close-ups, those tight, passionate close-ups of athletes' faces. But what we always are told again and again about Rue Narlage is that he imposed narrative on everything. Everything had to have a storyline and ideally a hero or a heroine.
Absolutely. He did three things. He took sports, and he later did this with news as well. And number one is he put the story, exactly what you said. He imposed a narrative. The second thing is he introduced personalities to bring this narrative to us, Howard Cosell and a whole line of others. And the third thing he did, the third ingredient in the recipe, was technology. You take a good story, some exciting personalities telling it, and then you throw a ton of new technologies at it, and that was a whole new formula.
So there's a lot to talk about tonight, but I guess one question that arises here, as we thought about Rue Narlage today, I mean, he's lauded up and down. Tom Shales, Washington Post, calls him a living legend even before he was one, a television titan. He says he was brash, he was bold, he was the Elvis of television. So he made it incredibly watchable. He made it incredibly alluring. But was he, at the same time, the kind of father of infotainment, whether he wanted to be or not? Did he put down the seed bed for that?
I think he certainly did, and I've been kind of surprised at how uniformly positive all of the stories have been. And I suppose part of that's appropriate. The man has just died, and you talk about the great things that he did. But he was a guy who had one foot firmly in the old-fashioned notion of classic broadcast journalism, the old CBS model that Murrow and Fred Friendly and the rest had done. But he had another foot mired deeply into the kind of news environment that we're now complaining about today. And to an extent, he started that. And there are people that would not necessarily be singing the high praises of Rue Narlage. Howard K. Smith, for example, Marlene Sanders, people who left ABC after Arledge started, decried some of the changes that he started that are the changes that are now business as usual today. So he did make it news and sports more watchable, more user-friendly, more consumer-friendly. But at the same time, he also did begin to march us down a road that we've gone down very, very far since he began.
I suppose a huge part of the reason that he's so lauded is that everybody loves a winner, and he had the Midas touch in television.
Right. And there's one other thing, too, is that when he was first put in charge of news, it was considered a scandal by critics and people in the journalistic establishment.
This is when he moved over from being head of ABC Sports to also being head of ABC News.
Right. They added that that title to him, and this was considered scandalous because he had very little news experience. One of the first executive to head a news division that had as little experience as he did. And people thought that he was just going to turn the news into a three-ring circus so that ABC could compete.
Whether he did it or not, it may have come to that. We're talking tonight about Rue Narlage. He died yesterday at age 71. Rue Narlage and the evolution of American television. My guest is Bob Thompson. Can you remember TV before Monday Night Football, World News Tonight, 2020 Nightline? Do we now expect television to turn all events into punchy, colorful theater? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're remembering television pioneer Rune Arledge tonight. One of Arledge's greatest creations was Monday Night Football, and one of his greatest finds was Howard Cosell. Let's listen to a clip of Cosell with co-anchor Don Meredith.
So it's three downs and over for the Kansas City Chiefs, and that's been their wont so often tonight at a time when they desperate. Their wont, W-O-N-T.
Oh, Howard.
The education of Dandy Don continues. We await the punt.
W-O-N-T. That's the way I say W-A-N-T. And the majority out there, all those folks with rednecks, white socks, and drinking blue ribbon beer.
Blue collars.
Redneck and white socks and blue ribbon beer.
We're talking tonight about the life and impact of Rune Arledge and the evolution of American television. Did the Rune Arledge touch bring us closer to reality or bury reality in artifice? Is TV now a medium of illumination or fantasy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Bob Thompson, director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University, and I'm joined now in the studio, and glad to be so, by Robert Zelnick. He was a longtime ABC News correspondent, worked for 21 years with Rune Arledge, and is now chair of Boston University's Department of Journalism. Good evening and welcome, Bob Zelnick.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You knew Rune Arledge personally. Bob Thompson has been talking to us about his impact on the structure of television. Give us a sense of the man who was apparently such a whirlwind, who had such an impact on so many TV careers, and really on the way we all see the world through television.
Well, Rune was a man of contradictions. He had tremendous faith and conviction in his insights as to what would make good television, how news should be presented at a certain time to a certain audience and by a certain star anchor. Or interviewer. He had less confidence in his dealings with people. He was a man who I think really wanted to be liked and was not sure that people did like him for what he was.
But he famously created the star system in television news and in sports broadcasting and was, I thought, famous for his handling of the egos of the big anchors.
Well, he was famous for handling that, and he basically handled it through flattery. His great insight was that
money.
And money, of course.
Boatloads of money.
You know, the money more than filtered down to correspondents. People like myself benefited from that system also. I wasn't paid what Peter Jennings was paid, but I earned a very comfortable living there.
Mike Wallace has said he freed the slaves.
Well, I don't think we were really slaves. Mm-hmm. I tell you this. You know, before I came to ABC, I worked with David Frost on the Nixon-Frost interviews. And one of the people who was there working with Richard Nixon on the interviews and on his memoirs was a young lady named Diane Sawyer. She later called me when I joined ABC. This was 1978. And asked if I could do what I would to try to get her a job with ABC in Washington. And at the same time, she was a family friend of Bill Small over at CBS, trying to get into CBS. So I called Rune Arledge. We did an audition with Diane, everything of the sort. And he said, well, since you feel so strongly about her, offer $35,000 a year.
It's been a long time since she passed that milestone. Which was about what
correspondents were making in those days. Maybe a little higher here and there, but... When he came over to ABC and started paying people like Cassie Mackin and Sylvia Chase and Sandra Van Oker $100,000 a year, it was such a stark change from the past that one correspondent, whose name you might recognize, Ted Koppel, tendered his resignation. He said, this is unfair to us. We're earning half or less of that amount, and so Roone lifted everybody up.
But poor Ted Koppel ended up doing all right at the hands of Roone Arledge. So did Peter Jennings. So did Barbara Walters. So did a lot of
people.
Yes,
indeed. Yes, indeed.
Bob Zelnick, as you look back on the impact of this man, he obviously made television incredibly alluring. He made it so appealing you couldn't take your eyes off of it. He had the instant replay and slow-mo, and Bob Thompson's been describing all the technical innovation that he brought to television.
That was mainly
first sports, then news. Yeah.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think most of the glitz you're talking about was in the sports area, and it was his whole concept of, instead of bringing the game to the people, bring the people to the game, and his famous original memo. But
Well, I wonder about that, though. Was it contained there? I guess the question we're raising here tonight is, for all the amazing talent that Roone brought to television, did he also create the kind of seedbed of infotainment in the very innovations that made sports so compelling in his hands?
I don't think he created it. I think he took advantage of the techniques that were available to do it so that he could do different things at different times of the day to different audiences.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't make This Week with David Brinkley glitzy and superficial and shallow. He made it deep and appealing and really the champagne program of its time. I think the same thing could be said of Nightline, because he figured an anchor of Koppel's stature and intelligence and interviewing skills could bring an audience, a serious news audience, to a network at 11:30 at night, and he was absolutely right about that. On the other hand, he came from an era when news was a supplicant at the table of the networks, when it was the lost leader.
Was never profitable until it came into his hands at ABC.
Exactly. And he felt that for news to be an equal at the table there, it had to be a money earner and worker at different hours, work prime time as well as the dinner hour and as well as Sunday mornings. And so he presented a different type of programming for different audiences at different times.
So what about it, Bob Thompson? Here's the view of Roone Arledge, simply letting television be all that it can be for each audience that it serves, making the most of the medium.
Well, I agree with Robert Zelnick in that it's true. The original sin of glitziness and technology and all the rest of it that would make its way into news was not Roone Arledge's fault. It would have happened anyway, and probably the way in which he ushered that era in was done with a lot more class than it might have been done by an awful lot of other people. And there is a sense in which things like David Brinkley and Nightline almost subsidized with its good, solid, old-fashioned journalism the kind of things that had to be done on the other side of the table. What was fascinating about his early years there was that ABC had never been much of a player. It had always been the third-ranked network. And two people in the late 1970s change all of that. Fred Silverman over on the entertainment side that suddenly brings ABC into number one in primetime for the first time in history, and then Roone Arledge in news and sports that helps to do that over the rest of the schedule. And once ABC became a player, once this was no longer a two-network race, that added degree of competition completely changed the environment of how everything, news, entertainment, sports, and everything else worked. And the competition, of course, resulted in some good things, and it resulted in some bad things.
I guess the question boils down to, I mean, we're looking here at a man who's being lauded as an absolute titan, a pioneer, a revolutionary. Tom Shales in the Washington Post says that how Roone did it will continue to be the standard throughout this industry, maybe for decades. So when the critique is made, Bob Zelnick, that TV is leaning into infotainment, how do we keep Roone Arledge out of that picture?
I don't think you do keep Roone Arledge out of that picture. I think you have to take a fair and balanced view of his career and his contributions and some of the things that may be judged in derogation of his better works. I think that some of the early 2020 broadcasts were horrible. I think they were a disgrace to the concept of journalism.
Because?
I think they were shabby in terms of the evidence. I think they hyped allegations against businesses and against individuals. I think they They were a crass appeal to mass emotion. Sometimes, you know, the correspondent who comes to mind is Geraldo Rivera, but he wasn't the only one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that
Was Geraldo a Rune Arledge hire?
He was actually with the Good Morning America at the time that Arledge came on as the head of the news division. And at that time, Good Morning America was run by ABC Entertainment. So he was a reporter, basically reporting to ABC Entertainment and attached to the Good Morning America show. But mm-hmm. Rune saw him and his eyes lit up, and he thought he could, you know, just exploit Rivera's talents. And he sent him out early on the Son of Sam case. And
a marriage made in heaven.
I remember that. I remember in his report, Rivera called the alleged perpetrator a fiend. And there was a conference a couple of days later where Richard Salant, the president of CBS News, said that this is taking television news down a road it shouldn't go, where you stand there and you call a man a fiend. So Rune Arledge said, you're right, there was a little excess. Maybe we should have said alleged. Then Salant said, you mean to say it would have been better if you said alleged fiend?
It just gets worse. Bob Zelnick, Bob Thompson, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. Susan's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to say, I think the problem is not the sort of marketing and glitz that has gotten into television, because I think that's inevitable, mm-hmm. the use of technology. The problem is that everything has become reduced to such sound bites that the journalistic objectivity is completely gone, and instead of just informing people and letting them make their own opinion about it, they're trying to shape opinion.
You don't see objectivity on the other side of the marketing. Marketing, fair enough, but on the other side of that, you want something you can get your teeth into. Bob Thompson, how about it? We hear the complaint all the time, television news is not delivering the depth, the detail that we need to make informed decisions. Fair, and does that somehow relate to this Titan's legacy?
Well, I suppose there's two ways of looking at that. First, we have to remember that there are now as many 24-hour news networks as there were networks, period, 20 years ago. We've now got MSNBC, Fox News, and CNN that are round-the-clock news coverage. And while there are a lot of sound bites in those news services, and while there are certain subjects, the economy, for example, that seem to be that television has a real difficult time turning into something that works in that medium, we do have an awful lot of talk about various issues that goes on and on and on and on and on. There are times after one of those hour-long shout fests on CNN or Fox News that I wish we were to the age of the soundbite, because I would have liked to have made that a little shorter than it was. So to an extent, you know, we're getting more and more news than ever before. The question is, is it as diverse? Is it the stories we need? The day after the midterm elections, a very important midterm election, all three of the 24-hour news services went to the Winona Ryder verdict.
And yet, last night on ABC, you could find Ted Koppel and Peter Jennings, Barbara Walters, delivering really heartfelt kind of eulogies to Rune Arledge. The sense that with his passing, with his death at age 71, his time is at least in some eyes already seen as a kind of golden age. Bob Thompson, are we moving beyond the innovations, the revolution that Rune Arledge brought into some new brand of television that marks a new era, a new generation?
Well, we are moving beyond. The technology is greater. There are 24-hour news services now. At the same time, I think in any sports or news coverage today, 2002, you can still hear the hum of Rune Arledge's legacy, not very far back in the background. So he did sort of set a standard and a style that's very much been imitated. The thing is that he's now gone, and that style is continuing to develop. The technologies are continuing to change. But it's based on a template that he put out there. So his legacy has certainly not gone to the grave with him.
Bob Zelnick, it's said that when Rune Arledge would step into the control truck, whatever you call it, where all the screens are, we've all seen it in the movies, I'm not a television guy, but he'd step before the huge bank of screens and see all the different shots available to him, and he would instantly know how to weave what together to make compelling television. What would he be looking for?
If I knew, I might have been the executive producer of a couple of shows. But no, I think Roon was a creature of the control room. He was never more comfortable anywhere, including running editorial meetings, talking to audiences, wining and dining correspondents. He was never more comfortable than he was in the control room because he saw the way pictures could tell the story, and by this compelling picture and that compelling picture, he wasn't oblivious to content, but he was a man who was very visual in his own response to things, and I think his perception of things as well. The other thing that I really think is worth an important an understanding about Roon and his background, he came up during a time and assumed the presidency during the time when the network was essentially owned by a single person, Leonard Goldenson. Mm-hmm. And Leonard Goldenson's way of dealing with the development of programming was to select people in whom he had a lot of faith and then take a hands-off approach and let them manage. And Roon and didn't even demand in the news division that the news division return a profit. Mm-hmm. So Roon at first wanted to satisfy Goldenson by putting something that was stunning and significant and in the public interest on the air. And then he figured, well, we'll also make some money so that we're not vulnerable to programming changes if Ozzie and Harriet go off the air or something like that. And then Goldenson in the mid-1980s, 85 or 86, sold to Capital Cities, and it became a bit more of a corporate mentality.
The corporate cha-cha
had to
came
be the
in.
Profit center. Mm-hmm. And then by the time Walt Disney took over, it was not even Roon's type of world anymore. It was too impersonal, too corporate, too bureaucratic, and not creative enough for a person of Roon's talent and energy.
This is On Point.
I'm Marcia Appel from Newton, Massachusetts. It's so funny. I just thought of, like, well, if they called, what would I say? Last week, they did a piece on the show On Point on the director, the musical director, Nick Page of the Mystic Chorale, of which I am a member of that chorus, and that was exciting. Keeping the flow of light, keeping the generosity flowing at this time, what I consider a dark time in the world. The amount is $18, and it stands for high, which means life. And I wish the radio station a long life.
Thank you, Marcia. That's very, very nice, and we appreciate your contribution. And also, thank you so much for sharing such nice thoughts about WBUR with us and with our listeners.
You know, one of the things about Marcia's comments that really struck me is that she relates to WBUR very, very personally. She wishes the station a long life as if we are a person. And for many, many listeners, maybe for you, this is a radio station that has that one-on-one relationship. We ask you, if that is true for you, to make a contribution to keep it coming, because you really are our lifeblood. 1-800-909-9287. Your pledges help keep WBUR going and growing.
I'm Gina Cervetti, and that voice that you've just been listening to is Steve Ellman. He's our assistant general manager, and the director of new media, Robin Lubbock, is also in the studio with me tonight to talk a little bit more about why it's so important that we hear from you with your financial contributions.
I think one of the great things about this show, On Point, is that very personal relationship that Tom seems to have with you. He's talking right to you, and he seems to anticipate the questions you want to ask, and he puts those to the people he's talking to, and as if you were there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Roon Arledge and the evolution of American television. Can you remember TV before Monday Night Football, World News Tonight, 2020, Nightline? Did the Roon Arledge era see TV become all it can be, packaged, thrilling, immediate? Or should TV be something else? Should it be something more? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Robert Zelnick, longtime ABC News correspondent and a man who worked with Roon Arledge for 21 years at ABC News. He's now chair of Boston University's Department of Journalism. From Syracuse, New York, by Bob Thompson, director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. And now, From Newton, Massachusetts, Charlie Pierce, contributing writer for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and analyst for NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. Charlie, give us a sense of the impact that Rune Arledge had, not just on the coverage of sports, but on sports itself.
Well, I know you were talking mostly about his days in news broadcasting, and I think that while he is certainly one of the five or six most influential news executives in the history of the medium, he is unquestionably the most important sports executive in the history of the medium. His effect is absolutely sui generis. He realized rule number one on television, which is if you put anything on, somebody will watch it. And I go back not so much to his coverage of the Olympics or Monday Night Football. I go back to the old wide world of sports shows, mm-hmm. which gave us, among other things, barrel jumping from Lake Placid, New York,
right.
figure eight racing from Islip, Long Island, the cliff diving in Acapulco, the World Lumberjack Championships in Hayward, Wisconsin.
So why did we watch?
Hayward, Wisconsin. I went to Hayward, Wisconsin just to see the place. There was a thing called the Cresta Run in San Moritz. It's what we now call skeleton racing in the Winter Olympics. There was one track in the world. The middle four curves, turns of that are Curzon, Brabazon, Battledore, and Shuttlecock. And I remember that because Rune Arledge put the damn thing on television every year.
Well, was it the way he showed it to us, or was it simply recognizing that, bring on the cavalcade and human beings want to watch?
It was the creation, his ability to take a sports event and make it into a story to tell. When Jim McKay did his brilliant work from the 1972 Olympics, he didn't do it in a vacuum. That didn't come out of the air. That was just the most compelling story in a context in which Rune Arledge took the Olympics and turned them into a festival of stories. This just happened to be the biggest, most tragic, and bloodiest one. But the framework for telling that terrible story had been established two or three Olympiads earlier.
This is, of course, the Olympics in Munich, where terrorists took 11 Israeli athletes hostage and eventually died.
Right.
And there we saw sort of two great themes of Rune Arledge's career meeting. Sports was the huge foundation, but he also knew how to recognize a world-shaking event and jump all over it.
Yeah, he knew. I mean, I think, and this is the highest praise I can give anybody in the business of journalism, however vast you consider that to be. Rune Arledge really knew how to tell a story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
Bob Zelnick.
Yeah, it's interesting that as wonderful as he was in the area of sports, it was a hurdle for him to overcome when he made the transition to news.
The skepticism in the newsroom of this sports guy.
Oh, absolutely. There was an executive producer of World News. Well, it was called the Evening News in those days, mm-hmm. before Rune came on, who kept warning the correspondents, unless we succeed now, we're going to be bossed around by Bozo the Clown. And everybody knew who Bozo the Clown was.
So make it work quick, boys.
Believe me, Bob, this is not an attitude with which I am unfamiliar.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely, and when he did his first 2020 magazine show, they led with a Geraldo Rivera piece on coursing greyhounds with live rabbits train them for the race.
Up close and personal.
Tom Shales, whom you quoted earlier in the Washington Post, said that Rune's show was such a failure that Geraldo Rivera reminded him of Ratso Rizzo, the street hustler in Midnight Cowboy. And Newsweek magazine said, you were talking about barrel jumping and whatnot, they said that Arledge was now creating junk news, just as he had created junk sports in his earlier incarnation at NBC.
This is not high praise.
But you know what, Bob? Hmm. The other thing is that look how much everything right now, and I don't attribute this to Rune Arledge, because Nightline is not a sports show. Nightline was serious television news.
And still is.
In a terrible time slot,
mm-hmm.
Which I believe, and Bob would know this better than I believe he had to wrench that away from the affiliates, right? I mean, that was pretty much their time.
1979, Iran hostage crisis.
I mean, ABC didn't have a late night show.
No, they started with the specials on the Iran, America held hostage. And I remember I was the news editor in Washington mm-hmm. those days. I was going up to New York twice a week for editorial meetings, and I'm complaining there. I'm saying, listen, you're doing this redundant broadcast on America held hostage on days when there's absolutely
day
nothing
after
to
do. Day after day. And the response was?
The response was David Burke, who was Rune's top assistant, put his arm around me and said, Rune has his eye on that 11:30 spot for news. We want to take it over. and it metamorphosed as we went into from Frank Reynolds starting out by doing America Held Hostage day one, day 20, day 30, to Ted Koppel doing the same thing and then calling it Nightline.
As we went into the day 400-plus. Charlie Pierce, Rune Arledge is credited with bringing giant salaries to sports because he made sports so successful on television.
Well, he had a lot of help in that one. But, yes, I mean, without question, the television revenues, which are at least at the heart of why athletes make today, and for that matter, why broadcasters make what broadcasters make today, is directly attributed to his ability, particularly – again, this is along with Nightline, his ability to make a decision and stick to it, the ability to convince people that primetime football would work. People, I mean, it's such a part of the calendar now. People don't remember what a flyer Monday Night Football was. It was ridiculous.
And I was astonished to recall, as I read his obit, there was no night baseball before Rune Arledge got things kicked off in the PM.
There was night baseball, but there's no World Series.
Series night coverage. I mean, it would all be daytime, and what kind of audience would you have for that compared to that big nighttime audience?
Well, what it did was it kept a lot of school children smuggling transistor radios into class. Probably created more interest in the English and civics teachers of America.
So, Charlie Pierce, all in all, as a man who knows the sports world and its portrayal inside and out, is it better off for the storytelling, the narrative, the hero and the heroine creation that Rune Arledge brought to it?
Look, by and large, I think he's got some questions to answer in the journalist afterlife for making George Will into a TV star, okay? But in terms of sports, modern sports, as we know it and as we are perhaps drowning in it, is inconceivable without the presence of Rune Arledge. It doesn't exist as an industry. Now, that means that he is in some way responsible for all the good and all the bad. That's how big he was.
That's pretty big. Charlie Pierce, I know we've got to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Just that big, all that's good and all that's bad in sports. Bob Thompson, you've been hearing the sports angle brought in here, but it was enormous, and it did, in Munich, mark this transfer, or at least demonstrate how Rune Arledge, even when he was sitting on top of the Olympics, would recognize what was an incredibly dramatic story by any telling and jump all over it in Munich with the news, with the terrorism there. I believe ABC had the only coverage of that incident for a long, long time after the hostage-taking took place.
Right, and it was brilliant coverage. Charlie Pierce gave a phrase that I think is a perfect one to describe that, and it was a festival of stories. It's absolutely true. And if you remember that Olympics, the center was the hostages, but Mark Spitz was winning all those gold medals.
Who could forget that chest full of gold?
Right, and that Speedo bathing suit. And there were people, talking during the national anthem, and there was the guy who hid underneath the bridge and pretended to win the marathon after 26 miles, and Frank Shorter thought he had come in second. I mean, this was like Rune Arledge was Chaucer, and the Olympics was the Canterbury Tales. It was all over the place. But then, when that hostage story broke, and Jim McKay, I'll never forget when he finally comes out and he says, "It's over, they're all gone." Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the great sound bites from American journalism. And I think in many ways that Olympics demonstrated to some people that Rune Arledge had a lot more in his future than just revolutionizing sports.
This is On Point.
And you're listening to WBUR. Hope you're enjoying the program this evening. This, of course, is a program that's here because people like you have made financial contributions. This is our year-end fundraiser, and if you've made a contribution this time around, then we do want to say thank you very much. It is whatever your budget can allow. It all goes into the news and programming here at WBUR. If you haven't made a pledge this time, then please do so now. It only takes a couple of minutes, and all goes right into the program. As I say,
one of the pleasures of listening to On Point is the fact that the show never takes a predictable point of view. Tonight we have some tough questions being asked about Rune Arledge's position in the television world. What is he actually responsible for? Is television even more of a vast wasteland than it was referred to many, many years ago? And is Rune Arledge partly responsible for it? All of those questions are not usually being asked when you see the lionizing biographies of somebody who passes who's such an important figure. This program takes some chances. It's edgy. and it's made possible by pledges from people just like you. So make your pledge to keep it possible for us to make it to bring it to you every night. 1-800-909-9287.
And you'll hear those kinds of guests on Point with Tom each night. You know that when you tune in at 7 o'clock, you are going to hear compelling conversation and, as Steve says, edgy information and programming that really grabs you and keeps you glued to your radio for 2 hours every evening.
And a program really that breaks new ground. It's not a talk show. It's not a news show. It's a hybrid of all sorts of things, and that keeps it on edge and it keeps it moving along. At the top of that hour, you heard Scott Peterson calling in from Iraq and talking to Tom about the situation there. Tom himself, a former foreign correspondent, two chips off the same block there. They were talking about the situation in Iraq in a way, you know, two people who understood each other perfectly, and then moving on into a much broader discussion about broadcasting in the United States. Wonderful versatility there.
That's what your pledge helps to pay for. So we ask you to make a pledge now. Take a couple of minutes. Call the phone, 1-800-909-9287. Go online if you like, wbur.org. But please make the pledge, because we are in a fundraising effort here that is at the end of the calendar year. Your last opportunity maybe to give a contribution to organizations that you'd like to support this year. We hope you include WBUR among them, because we're doing this for you. 1-800-909-9287.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Murray's Wines and Spirits in Newton Center for fine wines and assistance planning party beverages during the holiday and year-round. Murray's delivers, 617-964-1550. And 10,000 villages in Brookline and Cambridge celebrating Customer Appreciation Night, Monday, December 9th, from 6 to 8, with gift wrapping and refreshments. Information at 10,000villages.org.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers.
Over the years, we've learned that any task can seem daunting at first.
That's right, like a clutch job. When I give my brother a clutch job to do, he gets overwhelmed. But then I break it down for him into simple tasks.
Right. Put the car up on the lift. Get the tools out. Loosen the bolts that hold the transmission in place.
Yell for help to get transmission off your chest. You get the idea. Well, the same approach also works when it comes to a financial task.
That's right. Recently, I was confronted with a mountainous debt to my brother. By the way, I still owe you $100, don't I?
My brother owes me money, and I'm waiting for him to pay up.
Wait a minute. I owe my brother $100, and I've been paying him a dollar at a time. I'm actually down to 89. Here's a buck. 88.
Oh, God. See you, Mike. See what I have to put up with?
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
This isn't the same, is it? Getting a buck at a time.
No, as a matter of fact, I don't want the money anymore. It's too painful.
I was hoping you'd say that.
I can't take it anymore.
I mean, it's...
First of all, I can't take the mental anguish of not knowing when the next payment's coming, and I can't keep track. I think it's $90 you owe me. Chiseled me out of a buck,
man. It was eight. I remember the last buck
what,
I gave
remember
you.
What? Did you write it down?
It went from the 90s to the 80s.
You've owed me the money since the 80s.
See, by paying a dollar at a time.
You sent my blood pressure through the roof.
Exactly. But more importantly, I made it very painless for myself to accomplish what seemed like a daunting financial challenge. And you can take that same approach to helping WBUR pay for the news.
Well, we're not suggesting that you use the dollar a week strategy.
No, they're stressed out enough trying to cover the news. You want them to sit by the mailbox and worry whether you're going to remember to send your dollar for the week?
But you can pledge $10 a month. 10 measly bucks a month.
It'll be painless, and you'll be doing your part to support the radio station that you count on.
And when you think about it, it's a very good value. I mean, let's say you listen 2 hours a day. At $10 a month, it's approximately 16.666666666 cents per hour.
And isn't the station worth that? I mean, Bob Edwards alone has to be worth at least a quarter an hour.
Oh, and I'd go to 50 cents for Terry Gross, maybe 75 for Scott Simon.
Yeah, but it costs the station a lot more than 16 cents an hour to bring you all the great programs.
Oh, yeah, even our show costs more than that.
And that's why we need all of our listeners to do their parts. A handful of listeners can't do it alone. How about you? Are you ready to kick in your 16 cents an hour?
You know, it's easy to do. Just call 800-90-